bit surprised is that clinical trials are not all that reliable for all sorts of reasons. And Katrina will describe the work she has been doing along with others to set up processes and groups to deal with those problems. Over to you, Katrina.
Closed a large amount of its research and shipped some of the research up here to Cambridge. So since 2011 I was close to the Plighted Lucentis unit that we had at Granter Park, the science park just south of Cambridge. And then this summer, Pfizer then decided to close another unit. So they closed the Lucentis unit that I was working at, and some of the projects were closed, some got shifted to the US. Pfizer very kindly still allowed me to give this talk because I agreed to give this talk just over about a year ago. The schedule was that busy for this presentation. So it was very good of them to say yes, I could still do the talk. It's based on work that we started within Pfizer and Sandwich back in about 2009. And it continued through the time that we were in Cambridge, part of the census, and we rolled out this tool globally, and it's now still being used within Pfizer in the US. Okay, so thank you to Pfizer for doing that. The work that we performed, we are very fortunate to be joint winners of the PSI and RSS award for stats excellence in the pharmaceutical industry last year, and that's really the motivator for Peter to ask us to come and give this talk. Now I have to give an apology in that I am suffering from a cold, so I do apologise if I have to stop and take some water. I was here in Cambridge at Corpus Christi last week helping to run a non-clinical stats conference. I think it was a bit like being with freshers and being back at school the first time everyone shared colds with each other. So most people I know have gone down with the cold since. After you were right, yes, but quite a few people are real. So I do apologise in advance. What I also wanted to say was, in advance of the talk, is it's not complicated statistics that I'm going to go through today. And you'll very quickly realise that. You may have even realised that if you've read the abstract. It's not new methodology. It is a repackaging of stuff that as non-clinical statisticians we just ask over and over and over again to scientists every time we have a conversation. And it was our way of trying to make that conversation happen with us, and also allowing scientists to do a lot of the work themselves so that they kind of had a statistician asking those questions but not being present in the room. And that's really what we're going to be talking about today. So I'm going to introduce a bit of background first about non-clinical statisticians. Now I know there's a few of you already in the room, so feel free to sleep at that point, or disagree, or chip in. Actually, I'd like us to, and this is a discussion group, so feel free to add your own experiences and have a conversation whilst we're going through the talk. And then we can have a discussion at the end as well. We'll talk a bit about the challenges that face non-clinical statisticians within the pharma industry, and then go on to talk about the broader biomedical research as a whole and the industry, and then why we brought the ACT into existence. So when most people think of statisticians in the pharmaceutical industry, they think of clinical statisticians. Yeah, they are by far the biggest body of statisticians in the industry. And they think about them as just people who design and analyse the clinical trials, and that's all they do. But certainly within a large company such as Pfizer, you have statisticians supporting the full spectrum of activities that go on within that company. So they're there in the early days of target identification, when you first discover deciding how you want to interact with the disease. When you then start running your first high throughput screens, you run your plate-based experiments, your in vitro tissue bath experiments, through to the in vivo experiments, and the ones that culminate in that decision-making of choosing that single candidate that you're going to take into the clinic. But they're obviously then in the development phase, where you're running all your clinical trials. But behind the scenes as well, you've got big teams of chemists who are generating large volumes of compounds and looking at how you can take that single compound with a small amount of powder that the medicinal chemist created and bulk it up and actually then have enough for your clinical trials and enough for the commercialise. So you have specialist non-clinical groups who are supporting the scientists, a whole variety of different types of scientists within all those different areas. I said, going from the early research and drug safety, from those chemical experiments where they're looking at bulking up compounds and moving to manufacturing. The clinical groups support all your phases of clinical trials, from the phase 1, 2, 3, getting it onto the market, and then the phase 4 after that as well. And then all your other aspects of health economics, pharmacovigilance, and all the other areas that are used within the industry. Certainly within Pfizer, all of the statisticians had one unified purpose, and that was to promote statistical excellence throughout the whole organisation, irrespective of which niche you had to fit into. They were always championing statistical influence across the board, and trying to ensure that we had statistical support for every project that was there, be it a really early discovery one, through to then the product that they launched onto the market. My background, as I said, is in the research, the early research area, so really working with biologists. And that's where the assay capability tool comes in. So I'm going to focus a little bit more around the non-clinical stats role in that area. So we were there to provide statistical support to any research activity, right from when we're first identifying the target, so that new drug target, a new disease area we wanted to interact with, through to when we select a single compound that we're taking into the clinical trials, because we think it's got the right potency, it's going to be efficacious and safe, and it's going to distribute around the body in the right way and have all the desired properties. It involves a lot of design, randomization, analysis, and reporting of design of the experiments. Be those comparative experiments run on in bits of tissue, whole animals, got involved in the full spectrum there. More and more we were doing a lot of work in assay development and characterisation monitoring. So these are more assays that are estimating quantity, so maybe looking at the potency and trying to say, is one compound we've created more potent than the others? Does it look like it's going to be more efficacious, going to work better in that particular disease area? And we would look at being involved in the whole design process, looking at developing that assay, optimising it, using fractional factorial type designs, response surfaces, looking at the characterisation of that assay and its validation, and then long-term monitoring. These assays typically will run weeks on weeks, maybe even years, with hundreds of thousands of compounds running through them. And how do you know that it's performing today in the same manner it did 2-3 months ago? So introducing the idea of quality control charts and other monitoring methods for those particular assays. I'll come on to this on a subsequent slide, but the ratio of statistician to scientist is always low. There's far fewer statisticians around than the scientists are there. So a big part of the job is enablement of scientists to be able to do the basic statistics themselves and have an appreciation of when they need to come and see a statistician. So training is very key. So we used to run regular training courses in the basic statistical methods, tailoring it really towards those who are running comparative types of experiments, so those in the vivo world or even those running plate-based or in vitro systems that do comparative experiments, and then separate courses looking at estimation quantities, a dose response analysis, and areas such as that.
A little theory at this point. Mm-hmm. Basic training. training. This is essentially showing them how to do routine types of analysis. And then there is the possibility that having acquired that, they may then go and apply these routine methods to some situation where they ought to be more insightful, which a sort of routine-based training would essentially prevent them from doing. So what sort of advice do you give them as to how to watch out for this?
Interesting point. I would say most of the scientists come from university and start work and would put their data into a package such as Drug Pack Prism and keep pressing through all the different options till they found a p-value that they liked. A number of scientists would do that. Others would just go for a t-test because they were familiar with it and they didn't really know much about it. Others would go for non-parametric methods because they'd heard there were issues with t-tests and you might need to log them, but they weren't quite sure on that. So a non-parametric is what the literature said you need. Our training really was, I guess in that situation, the scientist probably more dangerous. So I'd say a scientist who's had our basic training is probably a little less dangerous in the hands of this software than someone coming straight fresh out of university. So the basic statistics training would give an appreciation of distributions. Why might you want to log your data? What are you looking for in the basic underlying data that you're plotting out? It would then talk through because of variability. That's your major issue with biological experiments. And then introducing the basics of t-tests and the extension into analysis of variance. But really then starting to say, but if you're running an in vivo experiment and you've got repeated measures, your software you've got one hope that come chat to us. But if you're in this situation, I'm really trying to say, you've now got the basics, you now know what to question in terms of, do I understand the distribution of my data, do I understand its location, and the real basics, and then what test might I need to do, and we equipped them with some knowledge, but really trying to guide them and say, okay, these are the scenarios where actually you need to come and chat to us. Because what you're capable of doing now really means something more.
And do they become sensitive to the need to consult you?
They certainly did within the UK, so within Cambridge here. We had a very good relationship with the scientists here. I'd say it's an interesting, in the US, and you know, something I was going to bring up maybe a bit later, certainly with people who may have interacted with US groups. Certainly within Finder, there was an expectation that their scientists should be self-sufficient. And they weren't good scientists if they couldn't do the data analysis themselves. And doing it themselves with the knowledge that they gained from university, not even after having chatted to a statistician. So the groups in the US have always found it very difficult to get in to the scientists and get access to them as much as we have had in the UK. Whether that's a Pfizer thing or whether that is a European UK versus US culture, I'm not quite sure. But certainly we were very fortunate with the group of scientists that we had in the Sandwich and especially in the Rockland Cambridge.
Thank you.
So yeah, the training used to be quite popular. We used to get quite a lot of, most of the scientists have certainly trained over the years. Another area we got involved with was software. So supporting existing software that scientists were using and providing alternatives. So Pfizer back in the late 90s chose to look at the statistical software that was available for scientists, and at the time it was just even lacking. So Pfizer built a number of add-ons to Excel to do basic dose response analysis, analysis of variance and other methods. These days you don't need to do that, there are so many good software packages out there. It's a matter of really of picking and choosing and guiding your scientists towards an appropriate package for the types of work that they're doing. But a lot of the work was around that. We also supported publications, so enabling the message that was going outside of Pfizer, enabling the good statistical practice within that.
And is it always the case that it's critical software choice?
Not always. The IT department within compiler would always try to control down to as small number of packages as possible, because then they didn't want to have to support many. However, if you could put a good business case forward for the use of a particular piece of software, then they were happy to do that. So, as statisticians, we had access to the usual ones, SAS, R, Simca, Design Expert, a number of different packages, especially some Bayesian areas as well, Windows, OpenBox, and those. Scientists tended to use packages such as Webpack Prism. There's an Excel fit for dose response analysis for doing their analysis of variance and basic works like that. We're using EvoStat, which is a freeware piece of software written by some folks at GSK and other device sciences. And it's a front end to R. It's a very nice easy package. We're using that a lot. We're fortunate within the UK that we've got to a stage with the scientists running the animal experiments that we would have a statistical review of every single protocol prior to any experiment starting. So that's not true within Pfizer in the US, and it's probably not true in a number of companies, but so we have a great relationship with the InVivo team and have been established over the last few years. So we got heavily involved in protocol reviews of the InVivo experiments. So typically a non-clinical statistician will act as a single point of contact for a disciplinary group like InVivo team, or what in Pfizer speak we call platform lines, but you know, they're big groups of a particular type of scientist doing a particular piece of work, so medicinal chemistry for example. Or, and I think this is probably maybe a little bit more unique to Pfizer, we're actually members of the drug project teams. Now that's not unique for clinical statisticians. They are members, they have to be part of a drug project team. So when a clinical trial is run, there is a requirement for a statistician to be part of that. There is no such requirement for a clinical. Resource is always limited, but we've chosen within Pfizer to put emphasis on the drug project teams, because they are the ones who take the data from all of these assays and then make the decisions using those data. And they finally choose the single compound that we take into the clinic. And I'll come back to that on the next slide. So really a non-clinical statistician's remit is there to influence the statistical awareness of the people that they're interacting with, to influence the research conduct, and to influence the quality of the data and the decision making that goes on within the organisation. There's a number of challenges, and the top one's one I alluded to earlier. By the time you select that single compound that you're going to take into a clinical trial, its ability to interact with the target of interest and actually elicit a response or block a response that's already there in the body, it's already baked in. Its safety profile is already there in that compound, and the way it distributes around the body, so its whole PK, is already baked in. It's too late to change it. So you're taking that molecule as it stands into clinical trials. You can tinker with the dose, you can tinker with the people it's given to and things like that, but the compound is what you've selected. So really, it's important to be there when the selection process is going on, so that you can enable that decision-making process. And that's where we have started putting more emphasis, putting statistical resource in that earlier stage. Now, non-clinical statisticians are there across the board, but not often where the decision-making part of it is actually occurring. So it's in that project team where they're faced with vast amounts of compounds and they're whittling it down and getting down, focusing down onto that single one to take through. It's too late and too costly to do that exercise in the clinic. So traditionally the numbers of statisticians in that early research area are very low, and there's a lot of challenges. There's no requirement for us to be there. As I alluded to earlier, especially in the US, there's an expectation that scientists can actually do the work themselves. They don't need statisticians to help out. Many scientists have had bad experience with the statistics that were taught to them at university. And as a statistical group, you're always having to defend yourself and your own existence. Because often you're in with clinical statisticians or the reporting line that you have don't always value you. So you're really trying to demonstrate your added value. Now, if you can reduce N in an experiment, you do quantify the impact you had. But running training and raising the statistical awareness of the organisation, how do you quantify that? It's really tricky to demonstrate that added value. The statisticians need many different tools in their support toolkit to help them in this particular work. And that's where for us the asset capability tool came in. But before I introduce that, I just want to broaden it out a little bit beyond the pharma industry. And let's look in the literature in a kind of a greater, bigger picture view. Back in 2013, Nature ran a number of articles and a special edition looking at what it called the challenges in the irreproducible research. And at the same time, they introduced a checklist for their authors. And in this article in April 2013, they stated, it's become clear that biomedical science is plagued by findings that cannot be reproduced. Science as a system should place more importance on reproducibility. And this article didn't come out of the blue. There's been many, many articles over the years discussing this, but really it started to come to a head a few years ago, and the volume of publication out there is just immense. During the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a really large increase in the number of publications stating the need for improved experimental design, conduct, and stats analysis. Back in 2003, Professor Michael Festin, who was linked to the funding replacement for animals and medical experiments at the time, published in TIPS, quite a popular journal, about the need for better experimental design. And in there he stated, many scientists ignore the basic principles of experimental design, analyse the resulting data badly, and in some cases reach the wrong conclusions. Now, he wasn't alone in saying this, there were many people saying it, but said that the tide has been growing, really, slowly over the years. I've just picked a few examples here. So we have one up at the top from 2007, saying about the failure of drugs in the clinic, so clinical attrition, could be actually linked to biased preclinical assessments of the potential efficacy. There's a paper in the middle there looking again at the risk of bias at the bench, this time in stroke trials, looking at why a large number of stroke trials fail. And we actually had Professor Malcolm McLeod at the North Clinical Stats Conference last week talking about reproducibility. We have something that's quite important actually. In June 2010, the ARRIVE guidelines were published. And these were guidelines for the reporting of animal research. And many institutions are now looking at this checklist that's been created under this heading of ARRIVE guidelines and using it as a way to improve the conduct and analysis and reporting of the trials, the in vivo trials that are being run.
Sorry to butt in again.
Yep, no, that's fine, please do.
But I smell a potential conflict here in that the more simple and standard the approaches which are used, the more likely it is that you obtain reproducible results, even if they are somewhat irrelevant.
Yes. The whole translation piece can't be thought about in terms of the applicability of the in vivo model and its translation into a clinical human situation is fraught with all sorts of issues. And you're right, you can't go too simple in the model because then its ability to translate is just eroded. However, if that experiment is run in a poor manner, and the conduct of it is inappropriate, and the statistical analysis is inappropriate, then you can't even think about a translation piece.
Yeah, but the result could still be very reproducible.
It could be, and you're right, you've really got to then think, the extra bit I think that we talk about in the capability tool is why are you running the experiment, what does success look like? And what do you need? What does your project team, and finally, what does your project team need from this assay to be able to progress something further? And it might be quite a complex analysis that's required, a complex model, complex analysis, but conducted in an appropriate way and analysed in an appropriate way. It's not all about making things as simple as possible. I'm not going to touch on translation today, actually, although it's mentioned a lot in here. But really, the whole thing around this was, if you can't even get the basics right, how can you even then think about translation. But basics being not simple, basics being appropriate for the task at hand.
The danger being that you could get it to, quote, look right, unquote.
Yes. And it's still meaningless. I mean, that comes down to the people who are using the results of that experiment to think about what they need. And that's, again, that's something I'll touch on a bit later, but that was when we did a survey back in 2009, was our biggest disconnect we found, in that the people using the data and the results of an experiment weren't talking to the scientists producing the data. So you had someone on a project team who was the lead biologist, say, for that project, going, yes, this is what we can deliver as an assay, going away to the person who's running the assay, collecting the data from them and coming back. And the scientists would be able to say, oh no, but you can't interpret the results exactly in that manner because of X, Y, and Z. And they knew the limitations of the system. But that got lost in the movement of the data and the results through to the project team. And it was that disconnect that we tried to improve. One of the more recent articles I've got on here is the one down the bottom in Science, which talked about when mice mislead, which I thought was quite a nice cartoon. And in this one, they talked about many animal studies are poorly done, and if conducted with greater rigour, they'd be a much more reliable predictor of human biology. So Lawrence Tabak was the principal deputy director of the NIH in the US at the time. And he stated that sometimes the fundamentals get pushed aside, the basics of experimental design, the basics of statistics. And the article, among all the other articles, really highlighted the issues of minuscule sample sizes and lack of randomization of volume. The following year, Science actually brought in a new statistical editorial board, so that their papers now go through a formal statistical review. But it still is one of the only boards that actually has that. So what were statisticians trying to do? They were trying to get in on the act. You may be aware, it's been around for many years now, of the Auburn and Bland series of papers that were in the BMJ from 94 onwards. Fantastic collection of little snippets of statistical information. The British Journal of Pharmacology tried to do something similar from May 2011 onwards. They linked up with a number of journals globally, including some in the US. And entitled their first article, Statistics Altogether Now, One Step at a Time. And it's the same concept of lots of tiny little articles on a particular topic at a time, some kind of bite-sized information. Nature Methods are doing the same, started in September 2013. They have their points of significance column. I quite liked some of the articles they wrote about kick the bar chart habit, and things like that. There's some really good articles they've got there. I hammered the scientists with that one a lot. And then you've got a few down here from folks who were with AstraZeneca, they've now left, but Ian Pearce and Pete Quirkins, looking at what they call good statistical practice within AstraZeneca. Similar kind of idea to what we were doing with Assay Capability Tool, but very much around the people experiments. But really highlighting here that really what they recommend and what a number of us would recommend is a systematic engagement of statisticians in preclinical research. So within the pharmaceutical industry, narrowing it down, we thought about the research as a whole and the biomedical journals. Within the pharma industry, attrition is the biggest issue. So it's the risk of taking a compound into first in human and through the later clinical trials that's just supporting on dodgy data, but weak evidence, put it properly, insufficient weak or biased evidence. Yes, there was a 2004 Nature article that said about 60% of the failure of clinical compounds during the trials in the year 2000 was attributed to lack of efficacy and safety. Now, Pfizer at this time had already launched what it called quite grandly its attrition task force teams. Quite American in sounding. But back in the late 90s, they were looking very closely at why drugs failed at different stages. They started on the late-phase clinical trials because they're the most costly. It really costs a lot of money to get a compound through, the first set of trials and then to these massive multinational, multi-center trials, and then it falls over. And they started to then track back and look at each of the stages and try to see what information do we take from the previous stage that allows us to make the decision to progress, and how can we improve our decision-making process. By 2009, the internal teams were focusing on that move of something from the preclinical area into the clinic for the first time. And research statistics were asked to review and assess the risk of the progression of these late-stage discovery compounds, these assets, into first-in-human studies. So we looked across the board at all of the programs that were about to nominate a drug to take into clinical trials across all of Pfizer's research units at the time globally. And we looked at the assays that were being run at that time, providing the data that the project teams were making decisions upon. And we had a number of review findings, and these were pretty consistent with a lot of the review findings that are out there in the literature. Sample size was being driven majority of the time by precedent. It was always 4, 6, or 8 in the in-vivo experiments, because that's what people had already done. Rarely was a statistician being involved to actually give them an appropriate sample size and method for them. Randomization and blinding were used in pockets, but were often misunderstood and definitely undervalued. The analysis method was really dependent on the knowledge of the scientist, what they knew how to do and what software they actually had access to at the time. It wasn't being linked at all with the design of the experiment. For assays that were being routinely run over time, where they were doing comparisons across time, there was no method of tracking the performance of an assay over time. Quality control charts were being routinely used. And then thinking about the decision-making part, there was limited evidence of people sitting down prior to the experiment and saying, what does success actually look like? Why are we running this experiment? And let's define a set of criteria that we need to actually achieve before we then move to the next study or move the compound to the next stage. There was a constant pressure of people having to get an assay up and running as quickly as possible. So assays were drifting from being an exploratory kind of assay and suddenly moving into a confirmatory stage, with the data being treated as equally valid. No kind of understanding of this data and this assay is still being tweaked, it's being changed, and things are really exploratory. We found that the project teams and the scientists' expectations tended to drift down towards the data that was collected. So, oh yeah, we knew we'd get that anyway. We could explain events away quite well, mainly because they didn't have a definition of what a successful outcome was, what we really could need. I alluded to this one earlier, there was a disconnect between the scientists running the assay and knowing what the assay could do to the project who were then using the data. And there really was an insufficient awareness of the impact of the deficiencies I mentioned on the previous slide on the quality of the decision making that was going ahead. So there are two key recommendations that were made globally from the research statistics team to the global research and development scientists. A greater transparency in assay design, execution, and increased communication of assay characteristics. And that you're now starting to see parallels in journals outside. Nothing to do with Pfizer, it's not that we spread the word, but you're noticing there's increased space for methods within journals, and the transparency is one of the key things that people are actually promoting a lot. But something that was probably a little bit different was this cultural shift that we were recommending, where the projects and scientists really needed to think about their whole preclinical assay package, all the assays they were running, all the data they were collecting, and think about how you then developed that package and developed your compounds through that, and thought about the risk of taking things forward based on the data that you got and decision making. So in 2010, the year after this, we were asked to do another review and got a bit fed up with having to do this kind of review process and thought, let's try and get something a little more prospective so that we can get involved a bit more. And that's where the ACT came. We really felt that people needed to understand the capability of an assay and how it could meet the needs that the drug project team actually had, and matching that up more clearly, so that we really could study the limitations of an assay, and then people using the data know what to expect, and then how far they can fit the decision-making process on that. And it's not rocket science, it's nothing new at all, it's the age-old questions we've been asking lots and lots of times. It literally was just, or is just, 13 questions guiding scientists and the teams through the development of an assay and its subsequent use. Any type of assay, not just in vivo, anything that we're running, any system.
Can you maybe give a couple of examples of both assays?
Yeah, okay, so the classic ones will be the in vivo experiments. So let's think about the pain research unit that I was in. We had a model of knee rotation, which was meant to mimic the pain associated with osteoarthritis of the knee. So an animal's knee, I've chosen quite a nasty one to choose and explain, but the knee joint was attached to a board where the knee could then be rotated. The animal was anaesthetized at this stage, and you had electrodes measuring the firing of the neurons. So you could look at the signalling, the pain signalling, that was happening on the rotation. And you could then, in a control animal, you would be measuring over a number of time periods the rotation to a different angle, and looking at the fire, the amount of firing signalling that was happening. You could then introduce a drug to the anaesthetised animal and look to see whether the signalling was depressed. And you could then look at the pain suppression.
So it's a kind of trial?
Yes, it's like a clinical trial, but this was being run within an animal. And this model is set up for any project that was running, had a target that would eventually take it into osteoarthritis patients. So then you would be able to run your compound through it and look to see, does it depress the signaling? Therefore, they would then believe it should be applicable for moving it through to human population. Translation of some of these models can be a little tricky. It's not that you could choose a dose or anything refined on that. It's really, does it seem to hit the target of interest and interfere with the signaling? And if yes, then that gave you enough confidence to progress to the next stage.
So that trial with the animals was focused on the transmission from the area under stress.
From the joints, yes.
From the joints. But without reference to perception.
Yes.
Because the animal was anaesthetized.
Yes.
Whereas with humans, you might think more of dulling the mental perception of pain.
Yeah.
Never mind what's happening in the joint.
Yes. There's very much. It's where pain is such a complicated area in humans. There's such a subjectivity to it. We get very large placebo responses in the trials because of that type of aspect that you mentioned. But if you can't interfere with the signaling at all, then you stand no hope, really, of progressing beyond maybe the placebo effect if all you're actually going to be doing is the major part of it. So the first aspect is, does the drug get to the site of action? So in this case, you have a particular target we're wanting to affect on the cells or the neurons in the knee. And then can, with those sensory neurons, can we stop the firing? Then you've got to think about many other aspects of whether that drug is appropriate to take into humans. But that's just one of the pieces. And that's where for a project team, it's not really just one assay that does it. You'll have started early on looking at, for example, this was a particular target called PanTrac. It's a Track A, B and C cells. You can take those cells and you can put them on what's called a plate. But how many of you are familiar with plate-based experiments? Think of your test tubes that you had at school, miniaturized, something about the size of my phone, just a little bit bigger. And you can get 96 individual test tubes for wells on that, or 384, or 1536, and I think they're even more micronizing that now. And in each well, you can put your cells, and you can measure a response. So you can start looking to see whether your drug is binding, or whether your drug is affecting that aspect. You can then take cells from sensory neurons and isolate those, clamp them, stick a needle into them, put an electrode in, and measure the signaling. And you can progress through lots of different experiments, and that's what the team tend to do. the plate-based experiments are quite converting easy to do. They'll give you a good feel for something first. And then you're moving on to something that's pumping the cells a little bit tricky. And then taking a whole animal, sticking an electrode into the right onto the knee to measure that whilst it's moving. And then you're moving on. So you have this trilogy different types of things that are really good. Okay. So these questions, I'll run through some of them. I won't do them all in detail today because to a lot of you, they're really new. They are easy to follow for scientists. They're absolutely essential in experimental design and analysis strategies. And the key thing is it documents the strengths and weaknesses of that assay and its procedure. And it gives transparency on how you can interpret the data and the results coming from that assay in the light of what it's currently capable of doing. As I said, it just represents the skilled experience of more than three decades of statisticians at Pfizer asking the same questions. And we already had this as a checklist for new statisticians coming into the group and saying, if you're interacting with in vivo scientists, these are the typical questions you would be asking. And we trained people up using these questions, so they thought, well, why can't we actually send them out to the scientists already? And we put them into the tool. And they're targeting two things, and this is where I think a lot of what's in the literature at the moment and in biomedical journals is very much focusing on this bit, the data generation process. The design, the conduct, and the analysis of the experiment. And it stops at that point. It doesn't then say, but then what happens to the data? Because a lot of the time what happens to the data is it just gets published. But internally within the pharmaceutical industry, we make decisions on that data to then go forward. You have a different end game, really. I think someone in the one presenters last week at the Clinical Stats Conference was very much saying that in the pharmaceutical industry, it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. For a lot of people in academia, it's very much a let's get the next paper out the door, let's run the experiments so that we can get it out quickly. You don't really think of the what's next, but for the whole pharma industry, it takes 10 to 15 years from target identification right through to getting a drug on the market. So you need to be thinking more long term. So the scientists who are running the assays want to produce data that can be used with confidence. They said what the drug project teams need to understand the context that the data come from and its limitations and appropriate interpretation. And they are the people, really, those teams, who are moving a pipeline of different projects through for a pharmaceutical industry, and that's what it lives and breathes on, is that pipeline. Senior leaders need assurance that the right data is being collected and used in an appropriate way, and that the interpretation of that is right, and that the risks associated are understood.
So what this is involved in convincing the senior people, management, about those points? Because it could be that there are known ways of convincing them, again, convincing you in those comments, so that they accept and press on. So the senior people then have to have the capability query or investigate what has actually been happening. They need to have expertise.
They do. Now, it depends how far up the organisation you go as to where those people will come from. But I guess typically in this one, I'm talking senior leaders and research units,
right,
who tend to be scientists themselves. Because they are the people who sit on the governance committees that decide whether a drug project continues to the next stage or not. So they will have the scientific expertise, they may not have the statistical expertise, and not all of them see what we're trying to get at. Some of them do. Certainly, again, I was fortunate with the leader of the research unit here in Cambridge, Ruth McKernan, who, although I'd say she didn't fully understand exactly what we were trying to get at, bought into the idea. And then allowed us to then hardwire the use of the capability tool into the goals of the whole research unit. So that we said, for all projects that were reaching and we named a couple of the key decision points in the life cycle of a project. We said at that stage, when we reach that point, the applicability tool needs to be in place for all key assays that are producing data people make a decision. So we got that hardwired because of the acceptance of the senior leaders. In the US, it's happened in some research units but not others. And I think that comes back down to the culture of some of them. It is quite tricky. But within Pfizer and within AstraZeneca, I know we've done Ian and Peter and the work they did on their statistical principles, we managed to hang it on some events that happened where we had both Pfizer and AstraZeneca had quite spectacular failures in the clinic, but were very costly. And when they tracked it back and looked more closely at the in vivo experiments that underpinned the movement, there were some issues with those in vivo experiments. We painted a lot of work within AstraZeneca off the back of that. And in 2009, when we were doing this review, Pfizer had a failure of its pharma inhibitor in its phase 2 trials. And there were ways in which the in vivo experiments could have been performed in a better way. And we were involved in the recommendation of that. So for me, working in the pain research unit, that I was almost preaching to the converted with some people, because there was always already an understanding that actually experiments had gone on in the past that weren't blinded, weren't randomised, and actually when they were rerun in a more rigorous way, the results did change. So we had case studies that we could use that really did capture people's imagination, their attention, and allowed us to start having those conversations. The tool split into three sections. This first section is very much around the decision-making part. So it's really saying, do you know where you're running it? Have you recorded that down somewhere? Do people understand what success looks like? It's that whole decision-making part. And that's a bit that a number of people don't fully cover in other tools and other aspects. And it's really saying, it's aiming to get that connection, that connectivity of the scientist and project team. So the creators of the data versus the users of the data. And putting them in contact and saying, in what way can you interact so that you can actually understand what you've recommended and what you can produce. This one we as statisticians can breathe by, it's all managing variability. Okay, it's saying, when you went through a development process, what did you follow a logical, sound process? Did you use design of experiment techniques? Have you looked at the consistency of the results coming out? Are you tracking it routinely using quality control charts? When you were going through this process, did you identify all your sources of variability? Did you remove what you could, control the rest? All that kind of stuff. And do you know the impact of the variability? Have you quantified the procedure? And then the final domain is very much around the objectivity. Can bias creep in anywhere? So it's the old age-old favourites that we talk about all the time that are still not routinely used, especially in neo experiments. So randomisation, roughly one. It's the three words that we constantly keep saying together, but they're still not used routinely. And you can see that in the reviews that are being performed across the literature, where they're looking at large numbers of publications and looking at the use of randomisation and blinding, and it's still lacking in a large amount of experiments. We talked about inclusion and exclusion criteria, outlier exclusion, and then matching the analysis to the design. So simply, as statisticians, it's the questions we ask regularly. But really, it's we use the tool in a few ways. Some people can use it pretty remotely. They've been through it only once, or they're relatively up on their statistical methodology. They know enough that they can run through this, and it prompts them. It either prompts them to change things or come chat to a statistician. It's a conversation starter, and it allows us to get in there and get involved in the matter.
Excuse me,
can
you ask what blocking means?
So, it's a very statistical term, actually. We're just debating yesterday with a company I'm working for as to what term to use. It's an example, for example, if you're running experiments in vivo and you have different batches of animals, you would define the two batches as a block. with the understanding that maybe the units within that block are less variable than the experiment as a whole. So when you're thinking about designing your experiments, it's thinking about operators could be a block, different operators, and you would design the experiment in such a way that you have, each block is a mini experiment. So you have all treatments running within that one block. So it could be operators, it could be different bits of kit, it could be batches of compound, it could be lots of different things. But it's a design part of your experiment which you can then use in your analysis to take account of some of the variability that's present in the data.
Well, the concept block goes right back to the original experiments and rules.
In the agricultural world, that's right, blocks were fields, weren't they?
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Sections of fields, yes.
Or sectors of fields.
Or sectors of fields, yeah. Plots and subplots.
Yeah.
Yes.
Can I draw a defense on that? Is blocking is something that you are not really interested in at the start because there are...
Yes, it's a feature of the way you're designing it, isn't it?
Probably usually a random effect.
Not necessarily. More these days people are using it as random effect. Yeah.
You might block, for instance, animal subjects into groups of size.
Yes.
And can then experiment within each size group. So then a size group would be a block.
Yeah.
But then that would be a systematic variation, not a block. You're comparing within blocks. So
there are many different examples of what blocks are. But as you said, it's typically a feature of the design of your experiment. But the key thing is you tend to try and make sure within each block you have all the things you need to test. So you can take advantage of that. It's very powerful.
Stratification.
Stratification is another word for it, yes.
Okay.
That can be used as well. Yeah, cohort stratification, there's lots of different words for it.
And I'm just also thinking about randomization and blinding. So what kind of, you know, bias or problems you kind of have if you don't have randomization and blinding in vitro or in vivo?
Yeah, so in vitro, going back to the plates idea, it's very difficult to randomize experiments on the plates, especially when people are doing dose response analysis, because they tend to serial dilute compounds through.
And you can't really do blinding because then you're the first thing you're doing.
Take randomization and then we'll move on to the blinding aspect. On a plate, for me, if you're not randomizing, your potential issue is if you were doing a dose response curve and you're looking at the effect, changing concentration, and you're looking at how response changes, and you put your concentrations from left to right, and you happen to have a systematic trend running left to right on your plate that you didn't know about, then you have an issue, you have a bias. So one thing people do with a lot of the plate-based experiments, knowing they will not be able to randomise, is looking at plate uniformity. So you plate out exactly the same thing on the plate, maybe a low response, and then you can plate out maybe a high response on another plate, and you can look to see the consistency, to see if you start seeing any consistent trends. If you do, then you start having potential issues there. But you always do run the risk with some experiments if you don't use a randomisation. With vivo experiments, it really does start to become important to be able to say, actually, I have protected against those unknown system bias, potential biases that are there with my animals by using randomization. So rather than sticking my hand in a box and taking out rats one by one, I've used a randomization scheme. Because you put your hand in the box, you'll get the slow one out first. And if you do all the one treatment first, you're going to end up with all the slow ones on one treatment and the risky ones running around on the other. It's just thinking about that kind of area. For blinding in in vitro experiments, these plate-based ones, you're right, subjectivity doesn't really prove it. However, in the analysis stage, when somebody's looking at outliers, for example, they feel they know what a compound should be doing, that, oh, I think that one should be a really good potent one, and they have a split of points, they're more likely to take certain things out than others. That's really where the subjectivity might creep in for some of the vitro experiments. So you need to think about the different stages, not so much maybe in the conduct of the actual running of the experiment, but maybe in the analysis part and the data handling, that could be where subjectivity comes in. With the pain experiments, people were kept in trenches of holes on hot mats. If an animal has a painful stimulus applied to their paw, that's then put onto a plate that has got heat on it. You're looking to then see how long that animal keeps its paw on there before it finishes off. If you know an animal is treated, you might end up with a pinch, or you know that might be a pinch. Whereas if you knew it was a control, you might slightly more trust as a pinch. So in that respect, your measurement can be very subjective. So however good a scientist thinks they are, unconsciously there could be some bias coming in. And that has been shown to be happening in certain experiments with people with cancer. So experiments were run in an unblinded fashion, and when they were rerun, compounds were working. As you said, there are some endpoints where it's machine collected and the scientist has no influence at all on the data that comes through. So it's not that we're saying they always have to be run in every single experiment, but they at least need to be considered, and you need to say why you do them. The default position is used, however, there are exclusions, and there are a number of exclusions. We then summarised all the domains in one big front page, which got colour-coded. So the three boxes at the top are the three different domains that you've seen. So looking at the project objectives, variability and objectivity. I gave a little summary as to our perceived level of confidence in the decision making using data. So this example is a mouse formalin model. There's another pain model where formalin is injected into the animal, and you are looking at the movement of the animal, the finishes. They're automatically captured and recorded by some software. So in this example, you can see that we have a medium level of confidence in the capability under the project objectives. And really because people hadn't benchmarked what a meaningful effect size was. They were using a traditional sample size and they hadn't really thought about what a successful outcome would look like. In the variability side, they needed to think more about batches of animals and looking at maybe including initial weight, things like that, covariates, and using a quality control chart to monitor that over time. And they were confident in the objectivity. And then down the bottom, we just have a little summary really talking about what success looks like, the target value, the required precision and replication. This slide I've kind of covered, so I'm going to whiz through it, but really it was saying that we have that objective of a single compound to progress the clinical trials, and the team is balancing a large amount of data all the time. So since 2013, really, the ACT has been used globally. It's still work in progress. You know, it's promoted by statisticians within Pfizer, but the idea is that the scientists own the assays. And then with the aid of statisticians, the project teams use it to influence their decision-making. Goals were in place within a number of the groups. Certainly within all statistical groups, and many of the biological research units had a goal for the use of the ACT.
When you are, as it were, refining down the results of many trials to pick out, as it were, the one you want to pursue, I think I saw the figure 13,000 trials or something like that.
It could be that many compounds.
On your previous slide. Yes. Anyway, thousands.
Thousands, yes.
It could be that a not very good one could come out on top amongst so many. So I wonder if you have a scheme whereby what is the number of the best results that we should choose in order to be confident that the really best one is somewhere in that group?
Good question. I don't think that ever been formally discussed, but I guess what happens is the first assay will screen out a few thousand, the next one will refine you down to a few hundred, and you gradually move your way through to until the final, maybe in vivo experiments that are running five or six through.
Okay. So in fact you are selecting at each stage several amongst the very many that were there before.
You are. So you'll start with tens of thousands of compounds, which will be run through the quickest screen to get through. There's always a risk that you may have screened out your best, I guess, yes, but you're then narrowing it down and down as you move through a set of different assays. Also, your best in terms of interfering with the target and creating a response may not be the best in terms of safety or its ability to be taken orally to then distribute around your body and get to the site of action. So it's a balance of all of those factors together as well. And those are all the assays that people are balancing the information from at the time. That's another whole talk in itself as to the internal work they've done. using some quite complex Bayesian methods, bringing historical data together with a shiny R front end as well. That's a really cool piece of work. So in 2014, we thought we'd share what we were doing. Other people were doing the same, so we thought we'd add ours into the mix. And we initiated a series of external presentations and publications. I won't go through all the details on here, but if you do want to know more about the tool, probably the publication on the right-hand side in the Pharmacology Research and Perspectives Journal has the most detail in there, with all the questions and really talking about how we're aiming to interact with scientists and use it for the advisor. The Significance magazine really is more of a general information piece, but there's a lot more in that gene publication. This is the joint rotation model one I mentioned, but actually it's a case study of setting up an in vivo model using the ACT to help through the process, and the scientists believe they had a more robust reproducible model at the end of that process than they needed if they hadn't used the ACT. So that plus one publication is important to look at as well. Going back externally, the headlines are still there. There's still a crisis out there. A lot of TOPS 2010, but these two articles, the New York Times and the Nature, are this year, this summer. And that Nature and Science article that I just showed on the right was a survey that Nature performed of just over 1,500 researchers, asking them about reproducibility. And of those surveyed, they said 52% said yes, there was a significant crisis with reproducibility. And they started trying to look at some of the factors contributing to irreproducible research and what factors could boost reproducibility. If you look on the left-hand side here, you start seeing selective reporting, pressure to publish, but very quickly you start getting into low statistical power or poor analysis. Further down here we've got poor experimental design. And all the issues that we would also quote. But on the right-hand side, when people look at what factors could boost reproducibility, the scientists said better understanding of statistics as their number one area. I believe the number three there being more robust design as well. Better teaching as well. It's still an issue. It's being tackled more now than it ever used to be. Things are changing, and the journals and funding bodies are requiring more transparency in reporting. They're increasing the space for methods, and there's a greater focus on statistics. The stats articles within the key medical journals are increasing, and statisticians are getting more involved in journal review. There's a big debate around what reproducibility actually meant, but they're now starting to come together on what that terminology is. There's lots of tools, checklists, good practice out there. There's even randomised clinical trials to look at the impact of guidelines. So this is an Icarus trial that's ongoing at the moment, where people are being asked to help out and review publications and look to see whether arrived guidelines have made any impact at all on the quality of in vivo research that's been published. We've got the Innovative Medicines Initiative launching their data quality and preclinical R&D proposal, but I think last week actually got accepted. And then you've got the National Centre for 3Rs launching their experimental design assistant, which is really about, again, improving the conduct, design and analysis of in vivo experiments.
What is this experimental design assistant?
It's a, an online tool from the National Centre for the Three R's. So in vivo scientists can log on to it. And it has lots of flow charts that talk you through an experimental design and try to guide you about the statistical aspects of it. I, as a statistician, I have to say my initial reaction, I found it actually quite complicated, but I've not delved into it properly. So, but it's out there for any in vivo scientist in the UK to actually investigate and use. There's a lot of good stuff in it. I'm just not quite sure it will flow with the presentation of it. So really to wrap up, so there are many challenges facing statisticians working in this area. The tools enable a greater visibility within an organisation. They definitely extended the potential that we have for impact within the organisation. And we believe that they also influence the quality of the preclinical research. And very hard to quantify, to be honest. Externally, I think there are changes that do give more hope for a robust future. High proportion of the solutions highlight the importance of the basics of experimental design and stats principles, yet very few acknowledge the need for more of us. It's not just me keeping myself in a job. I do think we have a very important role to play. But we are, it is very lacking out there in the literature. And that's all I had to say. I was just going to give a few acknowledgements of people within Pfizer at the top, really the co-developers of the ACT, the launch team, and the main guinea pigs that I had within Pfizer New Scientist when we were setting things up. And then also just a few folks who were at the conference last week who inspired a few additional bits.
Thank you. Any more questions?
I mean, you mentioned about transparency there. There is this launch for open data and open science, isn't there? I don't know if this is something that you sort of, you might be able to do it without even the journal's permission, but you know, people can actually look at all the programs, all the data, and try it themselves.
Yes. Yeah, that's happening more and more, isn't it? The journals are requiring the programs and the data.
In theory, you could do it yourself, couldn't you? You could put it out there as one of your recommendations, and then Joe Boggs can come and just check it, and if there's been a bit of bias, you know, they can then have able to pick up on it. Because there have been studies, there was a Duke study that was mentioned in significance, where they came to the wrong decision. They wouldn't release the data. But I realise these things may be a bit commercially sensitive.
That is the problem, I think. Certainly, maybe some academic labs might want to put their data out there, but again, maybe not, because at the end of it, the publication is the thing that for them gets them the next round of funding. So putting information out there early before the protection of it being published in a journal, they may not be keen to do that.
Because it's too late when it's been published.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's very true.
So there's a limitation with this transparency, isn't there?
There is. I mean, the journals are trying to do what they can. My understanding is the funding bodies are getting more strict as well. So when scientists are coming to ask for more funding for their labs, you know, for their next cycle, more and more statistics are being asked of them. So they are having to justify more so, you know, whatever funding body it is they're getting to. I think that is important. I don't know enough about that, having been in industry rather than academia, to know whether it's really going to work or not.
I wondered how you delivered ACME to the scientists. Is it a document? Or
it's a PowerPoint document,
actually. It's a PowerPoint.
Yeah, it's four slides in PowerPoint. There's also a website with more information on it, some case studies and examples. There's a one-page Word document, actually, which has been reproduced in the paper I mentioned in the Journal of Pharmacology Research and Perspectives, where we took the 13 questions and gave a little bit of blurb and summary about what we were after for each of the questions. So that's been delivered in a one-page Word document.
Things for each question that the scientist is looking for.
didn't go that far, but we did. There were, I can't recall everything now, there were some unit guides that we did create that really gave a paragraph of information with a few examples of what we were trying to get at for each of the questions. So trying one aimed at in vivo scientists, and those doing comparative type experiments, and another scientists who were doing the more estimation type assays, and really starting to say, I mean, the estimation field, quite often they're not randomizing, they're not blinding because there's no need to in a number of their areas. But tracking things over time is immensely important. And doing a lot of asset validation work and development work, and that's what we did. So that had a great emphasis on that. Which in vivo one was very much saying, you must randomize our blind, and use blocking those kind of techniques. But we produced lots of different varieties of things, because every scientist was different in the way that they could take in information and understand it. But the tool itself, we tried to keep very simple, as the formal pages of the table, the structures you saw in the screenshots, you know, I had over the pages.
So then the scientists would like have those, you could load it on that, like, you know,
yeah, and then they'd be stored centrally on a shelf with them.
And would anybody assess them in the way that you did, give them the scores of, like, the
So we were interacting with the scientists, and certainly I would be doing that with them. To chat through my interpretation of what we're seeing and what I would say. And we were trying to get across to them that red, in terms of low confidence, didn't always mean it was a disaster. Sometimes there's an assay that actually is the most appropriate one, the most translational one, and the most informative for you. But for some reason, you cannot run it in the most appropriate manner. Maybe it's sample size, maybe there's something. But as long as a project knows that, when they're using that data, okay, it still is informative to them, but it's much better to at least know the risk that you're taking in using that data. And that's the message we're trying to get across.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about what you just said, about how you can make the message that it's not the assessment of the scientists themselves, it's the assessment of the methods they use.
Yes, yeah, very much so. It really wasn't trying to come in and say, you're doing a bad job on the lasso. It was acknowledging that some systems are inherently tricky in terms of either the variability that's there or the way in which they run, that there is some issue there, but at least the project team knows about that, but it's not trying to sort that conduct of ecological scientists, which is really tricky. Some did take it personally, but it's easier if you do have a relationship with that scientist.
There's one thing at, so to speak, a higher level than you've been talking about. I'm wondering if you already have information about how that might work. Say, you're an independent researcher now, but say you were working for a particular pharmaceutical company, and you persuaded the research team to adopt your methods and your approach, which would be, in terms of scientific methodology, would be an improvement. But now, that firm that you are working for is, of course, in competition with other firms who stick to the established methods. And now, say your top management say, look, we've got this result by a method which nobody else uses. Because when we read the prescription of how it says about it, it's different from what everybody else did. And we can therefore be, well, A, accused of matching the methods and the results, or when people who might be considering purchasing these drugs, they look at everything that's been done, they say all of these use the same method, this one is using a method which nobody else uses, so we'll stick to the one which is standard.
Yeah.
So, you know, this sort of I wouldn't call it necessarily more elevated level, but it's a more outside level. The success of this approach would depend upon the wideness of its acceptance across the world of pharmaceutical industry, I suppose.
Yeah, I think maybe it might even work the other way. Two aspects.
I mean, I wasn't saying it's necessarily a type of drug.
No, it's something we thought of though and have pondered ourselves in that I don't think what we do here is so different to what's been talked about in the literature. If it was a very strange statistical method or, you know, something very vastly different, then I think yes.
But you are talking about intelligently adapting your statistical approach to the particularities.
No, that's true. Yes, you are. So yeah, I mean that could happen, but in one way, you know, thinking about now being independent, thinking more in terms of contract research organisation who is selling their in vivo model to a pharmaceutical industry, you could imagine an in vivo, you know, with the literature that's out there in terms of the robustness and reproducibility, maybe actually having a structured approach to the development of your assay, the way in which you're running it, and then using your data, might actually be a more unique selling point and a better selling point for a CRO selling their in vivo model to a pharma industry. Because I certainly have had a lot of interactions with in vivo CROs in the past, and we often throw away the analysis that they perform from the data and we analyse it ourselves. We changed the analysis quite a few times and changed the actual conduct of studies as well in the past. Whereas if I could see that a CRO was using a more structured, developed approach to their statistical conduct of analysis, I would actually prefer them over another, all other bits being equal in terms of translation and the capability of them. So that's something we've pondered in the past, actually, about whether it's a, it could be a selling point. But I take your point, actually, that being different isn't always good in some people's minds.
To what extent is the attrition possibly just due to their own use of animal models or individual experiments, etc.?
With animal models, I'd say it probably did underpin quite a lot of it in the past. The plot I put up had bars for 2000 and a bar in the mid-90s. And in the mid-90s, a large amount of attrition was due to PK. So the first time a drug went into humans, the actual ability of it to be absorbed, distributed, metabolized, and excreted by clay was very badly predicted from the systems that were in place. And that prediction into humans meant in many first in human trials, drugs failed. By 2000, that was dramatically reduced, and that was because of better predictive in vitro models that were put in for the antibody experiments. So certainly that can have a very big impact. In terms of in vivo efficacy models, I think it's saying yes, you know, there have been many cases where within pharmaceutical companies, the models, compounds have progressed through into the clinic and they have failed because of whether that's because they were performed appropriately or whether it's because they were more moderate in the tribulation isn't always clear. So that's a good point.
To what extent do you see genetics as helpful? Given we have lots of genetic data.
Yeah, I think it does play a part. It can help in identifying targets. I think it may play a part in the way that it personalised medicine.
I was interested in seeing that the motivation behind this originally came from big clinical trials failing. And there's been this theory in the industry for a long time about fast failing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Dennis Langham pushed that, you know, 20 years ago in the industry. And well, I've been in your position now as an independent business for 10 years, so I don't really know what's going on in the companies and whether that has really been taken on board. Now, this looks like it's been taken on board, but I wondered whether the culture is still around encouraging scientists to keep the drug going because they are rewarded for success rather than for killing the compound. Because that was a real big cultural hurdle. And so is that still going?
I'd say that's improved in that certainly in the census we killed off a number of programs, and actually people were rewarded for the fact that it was a crisp, clean kill at an early stage, and the projects didn't drag on and on. Having said that, a pharmaceutical, I can be cynical now, I'm outside of the pharmaceutical world, a pharmaceutical's world is its pipeline, and this was brought up by Malcolm McLeod and a few others at the Non-Clean Stats Conference last week, actually, and it's something I talked about very much myself. There is always a need for a company to show a strong, healthy pipeline. So it will always continue some programs in that pipeline beyond the time that it should be in there. But see, there is a better culture, I would have said, over the last few years, of people being able to speak up and say, this program makes no sense based on the data we've just collected, we should get it. There's also, when you find to many other companies as well, this idea of, Pfizer calls it, EQDD, early quantitative drug development. The idea being, back in the day when you ran a clinical trial, you'd be interacting with a clinician and they would say, our target effect size needs to be 10. And everyone would go, okay, 10. These days it's, where does the 10 come from? What evidence do you have on that? What data mining can we do about prior studies? What information can we bring in? How can we incorporate that prior data into our analysis or even into the design of the study in the Bayesian frameworks? And once we then have the results, what predictive probabilities do we have in terms of progression to the next stage? And it's a bigger picture now in terms of the whole battery of trials that need to be run, how they interlink, how the data from one leads to the other, and how the decision process should move across that. I'd say they've got much better at doing that. It's not perfect because the process will have been working for us. But it's more quantitative than it used to be. But there's still a lot of it. But a lot of it is the targets are getting it's true that the easier targets have got. And there's a lot of the neuroscience programs and the planning and it's tricky areas that people are tackling.
I like very much that you basically mentioned that the main thing that you want is to inform the decision making. While all this basically, all pharmaceutical industry are doing is statistics. So statistics is sort of my opinion, right? It wants to know, okay, after I collect all your data, what can I say? In that moment, I don't care about anything other than in the future. I don't want to say that this is significant or difficult. While obviously there are a lot of theories in about decision making. There is something called sequential decision making, sequential statement, etc. So obviously now machine learning is trying to address the same kind of questions. Is there any evidence within pharmaceutical industry of using this kind of approaches to try to guide all of these potential designs from the first stage? Or it's always just, my data, and I just care about passing this stage to the next meeting so that they approve?
Yeah, not that I've seen. Mark, have you seen anything? You seen anything within Bayesian or anything? Yeah.
I'm starting to.
Yeah. I mean, for us, the tool was the first place in terms of let's try and get number of experiments running in the program. then maybe you can start with it together a little bit. We've done it very informally by the front page we have and the conversations you can have in the room with people on the project team. But I think we discussed a lot of the scope of solutions. It's not something I see done, but it may well be done. So again, it's rather than the whole thing.
Thank you very much for a delightful call.